Hey everyone, welcome in to a daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're kicking off this week's daily editorials with a very special, longer editorial here with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, I wanted to conduct a standalone interview with you. We usually feature you on the weekend show, but we are time constrained on the weekend show, so I wanted to bring you on in a bit of a longer format discussion, as we have done before, to cover a wide range of resource sectors that you're interested in and also some updated thoughts on ones we've covered in the last few interviews. To start off, let's talk about the precious metals and gold's recent move here. Gold broke out, was on actually a fairly good run even before the Fed meeting, but after the Fed meeting and after some inflation data over the last about 3 weeks, gold did break out in a sense. Now, I know we can argue about if it's a true breakout or what stage of breakout it is. Either way, gold got over 1800 and then over 1850. And we also saw the stocks moving in a correlation to that higher gold price. So it's been just overall a better environment for precious metals investors, especially in the gold stocks. What are your thoughts on this recent move higher? Are you skeptical? Are you riding this train higher? Give us your thoughts here on gold, please.
Thanks, Corey. And it's good to be back on the program with you. In terms of this topic, my views really haven't changed from my last interview with you. I'm still of the belief that the broader financial markets will need to see a major risk-off episode, you know, March 2020-like, before we truly see the next leg higher in this precious metals bull market. This view is informed by the increasingly long in the tooth V-shaped recovery that we've witnessed since the March 2020 bottom. And the fact that gold right now is firmly being classified as a risk-off asset and really has since August, September of last year. So it's been a real painful 14-month period here. I will concede that gold has, you know, broken some key technical levels in recent weeks. But as of now, I'm sticking to the assumption that we're not going to see that next rip-roaring leg higher in gold until the next sell-off. That said, you know, as your listeners know, it's not an immutable law of nature that gold can only rally, you know, after big market crashes. If you look at the two most recent, major uplegs in gold, one occurred post-crash, and that was the one I referenced, March 2020 through August, September of last year. But the upleg before that, which occurred in, you know, spring 2019, through the end of 2019, that was a powerful move when gold finally broke out over that key 1375 level in 2019. That, of course, was not preceded by a major crash. So it can happen both ways. I think it's important to, you know, have an opinion of how things are going to play out and the direction of the markets, you know, medium term. That said, I'm obviously not putting all my eggs in this basket. If I was sure that gold was not going to move in the near term, you know, we wouldn't be 25% exposed to gold and silver as we are within MJG at the moment. So these are my views at the moment, subject to change. And, you know, if I was wrong, it would not be the end of the world because we're still well weighted to these metals.
Well, Matt, just when you're looking at the precious metals at this point in the cycle where, the bull market really kicked off. You can argue about when it started. Most people see it starting in January 2016, or other people start using that date in fall of maybe October of 2018. Moving forward, we normally see the producers move first, then the developers, then the explorers and prospect generators further down the food chain. When you're getting positioned at this point in time or a position you're looking at, are you more interested in some of those higher beta opportunities and the explorers and the developers and the prospect generators, royalty companies, producers? Where do you find yourself most interested within that 25% weighting in the precious metals?
I mean, I would say generally we have very much avoided producing miners across the commodity complex. That's just not one of the stages of the mining life cycle that I focus on as an investor. At the moment, we have one standard metals producer. And I've mentioned it on a previous interview, Western Areas and their nickel assets down in Western Australia. So yeah, that's just not my area of expertise per se. There's a lot of smart investors that are following the producing names closely, and I'll largely leave that to them. My focus is more on the royalty side of things. So we have some good precious metal royalty exposure, although I will say that number dropped relatively substantially after Golden Valley's was acquired by Gold Royalties recently. So we've since exited that position at a substantial gain. So our precious metal royalty exposure has dropped slightly, though we still have names like EMX, who I've mentioned in previous interviews, as well as Altus Strategies, which fill that void to some degree. In terms of development stage assets, I'm very much focused on projects that make sense at current metal prices or even, you know, less than spot. Not a fan of the optionality business model. I think it'd be great if we saw gold move up to $3,000, $4,000 an ounce over the coming few years. But I'm not betting on the, you know, low margin, high CapEx, low grade optionality plays, which will never be built at current gold prices. You know, maybe could be built at much higher gold prices. That's just not the style that we invest within MJG. And then in terms of exploration, as you know, regardless of the metal that you're pursuing, is incredibly risky. You know, odds are very much against you. So I remain a proponent of the prospect generator business model, very much out of favor at the moment. You could even argue it's been out of favor for a couple decades at this point. That said, I do have firm conviction that we're going into what's going to be a strong multi-year exploration bull market, and more money trickling down to the PGs, I think, is an inevitability. And also expectations are just so low for the space as a whole. And there's very few investors poking around there currently, where I think it's going to be easy for some of these companies to exceed what the market currently expects. So that's kind of the breakdown of where we focus within the mining life cycle.
So just following up on a couple of those points there. Okay, not interested in producers. I understand that. It sounds like you're looking for a bit more torque in some of these stocks, a bit more of that upside. But when it comes to those development plays, look, we've had a lot of comments that said these developers are undervalued. Look at what their, say, NPV is worth and compare that to their market cap. Sometimes the market cap is a fraction of this NPV, but in all fairness, we've seen this before. I've heard this argument for well over a decade that, look, these projects can make money. You just need to develop them and put them into production, but that's a lot of work, and unfortunately, it takes a lot of money, too. So when you look at some of these development plays, okay, you don't like the optionality ones. Do you like ones that are a certain size? Because sometimes we see the best economics out of these small deposits, but that can be a real risky game, building a small asset.
That's right. I mean, it is cliche. Many of your listeners may have heard this quote, but I firmly believe it. This was Ross Beattie, I believe. There is just as much risk in building a small mine as there is in building a big mine. And, you know, the implication there is you should absolutely restrict your efforts to large scale opportunities, because there's so much that can go wrong along the way. And if you get it right, you want there to be a big outcome at the end of the journey. So look, the rule of thumb within the industry currently, and this is admittedly arbitrary, but you'll hear quite a few folks talk about that 100,000 ounces per annum number. I think, you know, in broad strokes, that's a nice generality to have in mind. You'd of course also want to achieve that annual production profile for 10 plus years, and the longer beyond that, the better. So I think if a development stage project falls broadly into that category, you can consider it of size, you know, for potential M&A activity from some of these well cashed up producers that have better balance sheets than they've had in 15 years and are printing cash also for the first time in 15 plus years. So I guess in a sense, we're playing the producers, you know, through buying some of these development stage assets that are very high quality, high margin projects. And I think will likely be taken over at some point in the coming few years. So, you know, names that would maybe fall into this bucket generally, and neither of these are holdings of ours within MJG, but within the United States, for instance, Integra Resources, George Salamis's vehicle up in Idaho, or Liberty Gold and their Black Pine project as well as Goldstrike. Look, I mean, both of those shareholders for both of those companies have suffered pretty tremendously in the past 12 or 14 months, but those are the exact type stage and of development stage projects that we would be looking for, and that I think we do see, you know, transactions on in the coming years here, and maybe sooner.
Matt, what about also silver stocks too? Because silver has been a little bit more boring than gold, but boy, we all know that there are a lot of silver bulls out there that if momentum picks up, those can start picking up as well. But again, pure silver plays, those are also a smaller sector. What is your view on silver and the silver stocks more specifically?
Yeah, well, at risk of sounding like a rabid silver bull, I actually very much like silver in the current market conditions. You know, one point I'll mention, and I may have mentioned this on our last interview actually, but it's interesting. Going back to the very going back 50 years to the early 1970s, any time that we've seen gold make a new all-time high, we've seen silver either do it concurrently or follow within 2.5 years. And this is not an inevitability. It doesn't have to happen this way, but that's how it's occurred over the past 50 years. Should this pattern repeat, you know, we're about just over a year into this pullback in precious metal prices since gold made its all-time high. Should this pattern hold, we will see silver towards an all-time high within the next year and a half. That's interesting. I mean, silver's trading, you know, it would have to double from current levels to reach that $50 threshold that we saw first in the early 1980s with the Hunt brothers cornering the silver market, and then most recently in 2011, right at the peak of the most recent commodity bull market. So, you know, from that perspective, silver looks interesting. I also like the fact that it's a bit more contrarian. The space is a bit more contrarian at the moment. You know, particularly compared to earlier this year when you had the Reddit-fueled silver squeeze narrative that was permeating and a lot of retail excitement. Those that were deploying capital into silver, you know, at that time frame are probably not too happy, and many have likely been shaken out at this point. So you're right, silver has the ability to quickly turn on a dime, and there are a lot of fans and a lot of folks that like to plow into the space when it breaks key technical levels. But right now we're not seeing that frothiness or euphoria. So again, just with any of our picks, I would urge caution and focus on quality, not necessarily on leverage. You know, our largest silver position, and I've written about it in multiple investor letters, so I'm happy to share it with folks, is Adriatic Metals and their Rupica project in Bosnia that's just about to break ground. Incredible economics there. So that's our primary silver exposure at the moment. But, you know, it's definitely a metal that I would be more than happy to increase exposure to in the relatively near term here.
Good thoughts on silver, Matt. Yes, as you point out, it's usually a laggard to gold, but then when it plays catch up, it really does. And I don't think it's a state secret that I'm a raging silver bull. I have 24 silver positions, so I'm a fan, and it is more contrarian now than it was during that silver squeeze for sure. What was also interesting was during that same time period, though, we were seeing moves in other metals like copper, platinum, you know, lithium, different sectors were running. And a lot of people weren't focused on the little beleaguered precious metal of platinum. It looks technically like it could actually start outperforming palladium. And it also looks like it could start making gains on gold. Typically, platinum trades at a premium to gold. So I just wondered, what are your thoughts on the PGMs? You had mentioned that when you were talking about the precious metals portion of your portfolio. Do you like any of the platinum or palladium? They're kind of intermixed companies. Do you look at those through nickel companies? How do you play the platinum metals and the platinum group metals?
Well, you know my philosophy, Shad. You know, when I'm looking at a new opportunity, I try as much as I can to actually tune out the target metal in focus. Instead, just look at the people in their own right. Look at the asset in its own right at spot prices. Look at the company's financial structure. Look at the upcoming catalysts. Looking at the price to value, both on an absolute and relative basis. So I really do try not to get distracted with the target metal. Because of that, we actually have no PGM exposure within the MJG portfolio at current, just because I haven't found that investment to date that checks all the boxes and would get me to the point of initiating a position. All that said, in a general sense, looking at the metal, I agree, it's quite interesting. I'd say for a couple reasons. I think the disparity in price that we're seeing both between palladium and platinum is going to be rectified in some manner or another. I mean, we've never seen the disparities in price that we've seen in the past 2-3 years. It hasn't reconciled to date, but I think the spread will continue to narrow. And whether that means palladium prices largely stay flat and platinum prices come and catch up, or palladium prices, you know, see a major swoon and platinum, you know, holds its ground very well relative to palladium, that remains to be seen. But I think between those two metals, I would lean towards the platinum side of the equation. Additionally, I do see a narrative that's just starting to form, maybe bubble up, regarding platinum and its role in producing hydrogen for a potential hydrogen-fueled economy moving forward here. As of now, platinum is a vital input into the process that converts, you know, energy and water into usable hydrogen. And as it stands, I'm starting to see a little bit more chatter about that. So I think that's a narrative that we could see bloom here over the coming years. Of course, the risk is that, you know, platinum, even though its price has performed poorly here for a number of years, it's still a relatively expensive metal. And I know there's plenty of R&D effort out there to find alternative processes to produce hydrogen that either limits or excludes the use of platinum entirely. So that's the one caveat there. However, that, you know, that is a narrative I could see gaining increasing attention in the years ahead, and kind of being a tailwind for the platinum story. That said, you know, we don't invest based on narratives. If I find a company that checks all the right boxes and it falls within one of these broader narratives, then great. But that's the extent of it for MJG.
All right, Matt, let's switch focus a little bit here and recap, or at least revisit, another sector that we chatted about last segment. That is the phosphate sector. Look, you mentioned how you were bullish, especially on one company, just in our last interview. And a lot of that, or at least some of that, was on the back of the Chinese. They had implemented an export ban on phosphates and related sectors. What other developments have you seen out of that phosphate sector, and have you changed your opinion?
So I find phosphate, you know, very, very fascinating. Could firmly be considered a phosphate nerd here. I've been doing some thinking on why, and I would say I think phosphate in general appeals to folks with more of a Malthusian mentality. And Thomas Malthus, for your listeners that don't know, one of his, you know, key contributions was the theory that any species, humans or otherwise, inevitably consume at above the food supply rate, and inevitably this leads to a collapse in population. It's quite a cynical way to view the world. It could be different in the case of humans. If I had to wager, I'd say it's probably not. And, you know, as you know, inorganic fertilizer is vital to world global food production. At this point, that doesn't have to be the case, but we've integrated into our agricultural systems to where that is the case. Phosphate and potash are, of course, both vital inputs into fertilizer, as well as nitrogen. But of course, there's only 1/10 as much phosphate out there as there is potash. Not to mention that the majority of phosphate reserves that are out there are in Morocco, in the Western Sahara. So not necessarily in friendly territories, so to speak. Update since we last talked, there actually was a significant development just in early November, so we're talking a couple weeks ago, on the heels of the Chinese banning phosphate exports through the summer of 2022. We then had the Russians come out and not reinstate an outright ban, but put quotas on the export of complex nitrogen fertilizers. And this does include MAP and DAP, which are the two key phosphate products that do go into fertilizer production. So that was another bit of a shock to the market. It shows that the Russians are prioritizing domestic fertilizer demand, which makes sense from a political and a stability perspective within the country. So now we have another major country involved in the fertilizer supply chain that is curtailing supplies just at a time where, you know, prices are already rising significantly due to the disruption caused by rising energy prices. So interesting timing there. I'd also say on the energy metal side of things, Tesla announced a further shift to LFP cathodes. That's lithium iron phosphate cathodes. And you'll notice that these neglect nickel, which is a higher priced metal. And there's, of course, some security of supply concerns revolving around nickel and its role in the EV revolution. And previously, you'd seen Tesla shift its standard range production of Chinese vehicles to LFP. But in the United States, both the standard range and long range were both still using the NMC cathode chemistry. We've now seen Tesla come out and say that now within the United States and actually globally, all of their standard range vehicles will be shifting to this LFP cathode chemistry, whereas as of now, the long range vehicles and higher performance vehicles are still going to use NMC. So that's a pretty significant shift for, you know, the automaker producer that's at the forefront of this EV revolution. You know, it got me thinking about whether there is the potential for phosphate to start being considered a battery metal in either the months or years ahead. I think there's a chance, and potentially, you know, the narrative is just starting to form as we speak. However, I would caution that we're certainly not there yet. I mean, for some context, annual phosphate supply is just under 200 million tons per annum. And I'd say in the very, very most optimistic scenario, in terms of both EV adoptions generally and also adoption of LFP cathodes within the industry, we could maybe see at the very top end, you know, 10 million tons of phosphate demand for the battery energy, you know, by mid-decade. So we'll say over the next 4 to 5 years. So that would still be, you know, 5%. That would, in the most optimistic scenario, be 5% of current global supply. So it's not entirely insignificant, but it's also probably not a game changer for the phosphate market at this point. But of course, you know, developments in these shifting chemistries and the preferences of automakers is something that I'm going to continue to follow very, very closely. And, you know, perhaps at a later date here, a couple of years down the line, folks may be viewing phosphate as almost a hedge to their nickel exposure in case we see automakers flee from the NMC cathode chemistry, you know, sooner than currently expected.
So, Matt, what about the whole battery metal narrative? Because I think, unfortunately, in a sense, almost too many metals have been brought into this whole potential battery metal bullish argument, and it has almost diluted some of the water. What are you focused on when you do look towards battery metals and this general global move towards cleaner energy?
That's right. Well, I think there's a reason that so many metals have been brought into the fold. And, you know, the reality is that we're transforming the way that electricity is generated globally and the way that it's distributed to folks. So, you know, and there are a huge amount of metals that play, you know, at least some role in that. You know, I'd say with broad strokes, you know, copper has to be towards the top of the list, just given its integral role in transmission of electricity from point A to point B. As you know, we're going to be continually upgrading grids and infrastructure both across the United States and globally to adapt to this decarbonization push. Copper is going to be much needed there. Additionally, the amount of copper needed for both solar and wind production is surmountable, is significant, particularly offshore wind turbines, you know, use an order of magnitude more copper than even their onshore counterparts, which I think is quite interesting. As you know, the world's largest offshore wind turbine project was recently commissioned. So it's interesting timing there. So copper has to be a part of that narrative unquestionably. Uranium as well. I mean, I don't need to spend too much time covering that metal. There's a lot of chatter, a lot of excitement, a lot of folks that are very much plugged into that industry. I will say, though, that I am a long-term believer in nuclear energy. And as folks know, uranium is the integral feedstock to provide nuclear, which is the only form of baseload power generation that can go around the clock without any CO2 emissions. But again, you know, one of the concerns for me regarding uranium is just the amount of speculative excitement we're seeing particularly involving many of the junior equities there, which really don't have any chance of putting their assets into production this cycle or potentially even the next cycle. So we do have some good uranium exposure within MJG. We're at 8-9% of our weighted portfolio at the moment. And, it's going to probably stay in that range for the foreseeable future, though we have taken significant profits on the way up with some of our uranium-focused holdings. Lithium as well has a similarly euphoric environment to uranium. So we actually haven't had any lithium exposure within MJG since all the way back in 2017. Many investors would be feeling a sense of FOMO because unquestionably lithium equities have done very well in recent months and quarters. But, from the MJG perspective, we have very healthy battery metal exposure at the moment, close to 50% of the portfolio weighted towards battery metals. Copper is more than half of that, I should add. So I know that if lithium continues to outperform, that's fine. It will just mean that some of this money will start to trickle in into some of the less obvious battery metals. And then, as I mentioned in previous interviews here, we do have some good nickel exposure. Also, just under 10% of our weighted portfolio. And then some vanadium as well through Strategic Resources, which is admittedly a very speculative name, but with very, very strong management and backers. And that was the company that I highlighted as the featured investment in our most recent July 2021 investor letter. So that's kind of how we're exposed to the battery or energy metals as we speak.
Well, Matt, just circling back to copper again, because it is such a highly followed metal, there are a lot of investors that tend to migrate over from the precious metals into the base metals eventually in their investing journey. Do you like to play I know the answer. You like the explorers and the developers probably more than the producers. But there was a big disconnect at the beginning of this year that was quite noticeable, where copper prices were moving to all-time highs. The producers were doing quite well. The mid-tiers, the larger, even some of the smaller producers were really off to the races. Even the ETF COPEX, COPX, that tracks the larger copper miners, gone up 3 to 5 times. So it was quite a move. But most of the juniors did not really keep track with that move. They lagged it. What do you think's behind the lag in the juniors in the copper space? And do you see that rectifying itself as we move forward?
Yeah, I mean, I do view it as an opportunity. I don't think many folks would dispute at the moment that we need major copper discoveries in the month or in the years and decades ahead here. If we're to get anywhere close to these decarbonization goals that have been set on a global stage. So yeah, I think that's right in the wheelhouse, for the prospect generators, for the development companies, for management teams that have made significant, copper discoveries in the past. So yeah, there's a few ways to go about that. One would be to invest in the prospect generators that have management teams with the prerequisite experience to make a major discovery that could move the needle for a major, at least a mid-tier copper miner. And we have a couple copper-focused PGs within our portfolio that really haven't moved at all. As we've seen copper move from the low $2 range up into the mid $4 range as we speak, I absolutely view that as an opportunity. There is a reason for that, though. I mean, if you want to speculate on higher copper prices, the most obvious thing to do is buy the metal itself, or to buy the producers, provide significant leverage to continued increases. So I don't think it's all too confusing why this has taken place. I'm just a little surprised, I guess, that money hasn't trickled as far downstream as I would have expected at this point. In terms of development stage copper plays, we actually don't have any major development, high quality development stage copper names in the portfolio as we speak. I guess you could consider Salazar Resources to fall into that category. Salazar is a company I'm comfortable mentioning, as I have written about it in the past five, six MJG investor letters. They are a prospect generator by trade, but I would argue that their full valuation, as it stands, is backed by a 25% free carried interest in the Curipamba project down in Ecuador, which is owned by Adventus Mining. Excellent project. Medium size. It's not massive, but it's not too small. But very high grades, very solid economics. We'll see if management can deliver and get the environmental permits over the finish line, secure social license, and get this project into construction early late next year. I'd say in the best case scenario. So that would kind of be more of the development stage exposure within MJG. And then we have quite a few royalty focused names with major or at least healthy copper exposure. So, the one on top of the list would be Nova Royalty, which is a company I've written about in the past couple MJG letters. They're one of our larger holdings. It's been a very large winner for the fund. We were involved with that company from before it was publicly traded. And then also EMX and Alta Strategies are two other royalty names or royalty generation names that we do own and that I've talked about publicly previously. Both of them have beefed up their copper exposure pretty significantly with the recent purchase of NSR covering the Caserones project down in Chile, operated by JX Nippon. So those companies have a good exposure, good diversification across the metal, the suite of metals, so to speak, but are beefing up the copper exposure as well. So I classify those both at this point as copper-focused positions as well.
All right, Matt, let's wrap it up here then, just with a little summary on some of the moves you've made in the MJG portfolio, because really ever since we've been chatting, I think dating back to April, you had mentioned that you weren't making many trades. You weren't making any trades. You were, I think, waiting for markets to show you a bit more direction, but I understand you've added a couple positions to the portfolio. What insights can you give us here as to why now?
Well, I can provide some insights here. I will say that we've added two new positions to the portfolio in recent weeks since we last spoke. And yeah, as you mentioned, first new names added to the MJG portfolio since early April. So it was over 6 months of waiting. That was not easy sitting on my hands over that period. They both became numb within a couple months. But, as of now, we have initiated two new positions. They're very thinly traded. I'm still accumulating, so I'm not comfortable talking about them publicly at this point. However, I can say that both of them share quite a few characteristics. The first is that they are both prospect generators. So they're both employing the prospect generation business model of going out, staking projects, advancing them to drill-ready stages, and then bringing in outside parties, whether they're juniors, mid-tier, seniors, to spend their own money to advance them. It's a business model, as I mentioned, very much out of favor, but one that is still near and dear to my heart. Second would be that both of these companies are run by geologists, and both of these management teams have made significant discoveries in recent years. So they have a track record of creating value for shareholders in both cases. And I think all investments start with people at the end of the day. It's cliche. It's very much true, especially the earlier stage you get. So that's extremely important to me. That's another similarity. I mean, they're both primarily focused on precious metals. They do have some battery metal exposure, to my understanding, within their broader portfolios. But I would say very much precious metal focused. And that's, part of the reason I'm attracted to these names at the moment. As we all know, until recent weeks, precious metals have been very much out of favor. Relative to the battery metals and the rest of the metals complex since late last year. Another key that both of these companies have what I would consider hidden royalty portfolios that I would argue are not receiving any value from the market currently. And in both cases, these royalty portfolios were acquired not by going out and buying royalties, from other third parties, but instead by, true royalty generation over a number of years. And there's a lot of competition amongst junior royalty companies as we speak to scale and beef up their portfolios. I think we're going to see more and more deals with some of these prospect generators as they come down and pay either, cash or shares to acquire some of these royalties that are currently receiving no value. That could be a catalyst, I think, to drive further interest in prospect generators. And then I'll say finally, and probably most importantly, both of these investments have what I describe as quantifiable downside. And this is going to be a particular point of emphasis for me, really as long as this risk on market rally that we've seen off of the March 2020 bottom continues. I'm just as interested in downside risk as I am the potential upside risk in this type of market environment. Of course, that will change, you know, when we're in the throes of the next sell-off. But as of now, I'm shifting increasingly towards caution. And so both of these companies, over half of their market caps for both of them are covered by cash and marketable securities. And that's important to me because, well, for a couple of reasons. First is that when we do have that next, you know, major risk-off panic, whatever it will be, and it will come, it may not be in the near term, but it will come. Names like these have muted downside. So they'll help, you know, mute the downside of the overall portfolio. And as we know, volatility can be very painful in this space. So I think that's a key advantage. And then additionally, because of this, these are both names where if they fell 20, 25, 30, 35%, you know, during a major panic, I'd be thrilled to double and triple down on our positions. So in that respect, it really kind of passes the age-old value investing test, where you run the thought experiment and you think, should this name fall 30%? Do I have enough conviction in it where I'm going to double and triple down? Or am I going to flee and hit the exits because I don't? And in both of these cases, I can say, you know, firmly that we would be increasing our exposure into said scenario. So it checks that box as well. So yeah, needless to say, I'm pretty excited. It's been quite a while since we've initiated some new positions. And, you know, as we speak, every few days, chipping away on the open market for these two names. And yeah, we'll see how things go as we head into the new year.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up here. Very interesting comments, as always. And even some of your comments there at the very end, shifting maybe a little bit more defensively, making sure that you have that downside risk protected in the stocks that you're entering right now. Matt, we're definitely going to be chatting with you again as we transition into next year. But as always, we really appreciate you taking the time, especially on this longer format interview that I hope all of you listening enjoyed. Matt, thank you as always for your time, buddy. I hope you have a great week and a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, gentlemen. It's been fun.